developing those meaningful relationships, that to me is what it's all about. And I think how you can differentiate yourself as a banker or as any employee, frankly, is just putting in the time.
This is Can Do, Lessons from Savvy Montana Entrepreneurs, a podcast that explores why Montana leads the nation in entrepreneurship and business startups. I'm Arnie Sherman. The Scott family is quite unique in the banking world. The family runs the publicly traded 120-office, 6-state, $12 billion First Interstate Bank system like it was still a small-town bank from Billings, Montana. On today's episode of Can Do, we will be talking with James Scott Jr., grandson of the founder, Homer Scott, about the history of First Interstate Bank, as well as who and what the bank finances and invests in, and how you can succeed in today's competitive landscape. This show is made possible with support from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. James, welcome to the show. I first want to spend a little time talking with you about the fascinating structure of the First Interstate Bank system's operation, its governance, its family organization, its interaction. Because as I've read and know, you have a family assembly, a council of elders, Scott Family Services to help heirs with financial planning. How does that all work? And what was the genesis of that?
You know, I think the way that First Interstate is structured these days is fairly common among lots of publicly traded companies in that it's got a board of directors, it's got obviously its employees, and it's got a CEO that you know provides the oversight of the business. What makes First Interstate unique in some ways is that it's still a family-controlled company in that the family, the Scott family, has got, I'd say, probably 40% of the economic ownership and over 70% of the vote. And so unlike, let's say, a Procter & Gamble or a company like that that's public and has really, frankly, institutional ownership, the Scott family provides patient capital and is and will plan to be, kind of the family ownership for the time being.
So you have family members. You're the grandson of the founder, Homer Scott.
That's right.
Founded the bank in 1968. Your father is chairman of the board of the bank.
Right.
And there are many other relatives involved in the bank.
Yeah.
Right. Was it sort of preordained, you know, that you were going to come into the family business, or did you have a choice?
No, I did have a choice. You know, so I maybe had a circuitous career to banking when I was in college, and even before then, I really loved music, and so I spent most of my time at the University of Colorado focused on the music industry, and at one point in time, thought I was going to be, an audio engineer, and was for a while. I worked in a number of theaters and was a touring sound engineer, went to San Francisco, and I did that for a while as well. But I'd had the opportunity to work as a teller, in high school and college. And after a few years in the Bay Area, when I moved back home, I'd graduated at that time and had a business degree. And so I was a management trainee at the bank, and that's really when I sort of began my banking career. But it was a little bit of a path to get there.
Sure. And as a family business, I mean, it's not lost on other employees that you're the grandson of the founder, right? So how do you prepare yourself to be in that kind of position in the banking kind of pecking order?
I've been told by my uncle and probably through my grandfather that if you're a Scott family member, you've got to work 110% or 120% because you got to work harder than everybody else there. And that was a little hard for me, I think. I chose to, after my management training period, and I worked for the bank for a few years, I chose to leave and I went to Denver, went back to Colorado and got a grad degree at the University of Denver. And then I worked for another bank for about 5 years because I think I really wanted to get some reps outside of the family company and really kind of develop some credibility outside of the family business.
So you have generational layers. So your generation, or maybe even you specifically, what skills do you bring to the bank now that add value in that kind of family-run business?
I'd say primarily a deep connection to the family values and an understanding of the history. I guess knowing my father and his brother and sister and how they've held themselves and, their sense of commitment to community and work ethic, you know, and I think just commitment to the company and our employees. And just in that, I've had the opportunity to get to know quite a number of our employees through the company in a variety of markets over time, and have good relationships with those folks.
You know, as I alluded to early on, there's a family assembly, a council of elders. What I found most interesting was Scott Family Services to sort of help with financial planning and the future for, and you're on the board of Scott Family Services, are you not?
I am. You know, Scott Family Services really came out of, maybe if I can kind of back up a little bit,
sure.
Talk a little bit about the family architecture. So in 1993, which was right around when my grandfather passed away, the family, really the second generation, my father, his brothers and sister, and their children, what were then what we call the third generation of Scott family, had all kind of gotten together in the Dayton, Wyoming Community Center. And we, you know, met together as a collective unit and talked about what it meant for the family, what it wanted to be its legacy, how we were going to kind of think about governing and or what it meant to be owners for these entities. And so we knew we needed help. I think we worked with a guy, Peter Davis, I think was his name, out of Chicago, is somebody that was recommended to us. And we really started thinking about, creation of a ownership council or a family council. There's a sort of new concepts in family governance at the time. And so we, over the course of a few years, formed a family council. And the family council served to provide a unified voice for ownership matters. And really that grew into not only just ownership, but family harmony, family unity, some of the things that really are the glue that keep a family together. Because we were such a large family at the time, we kind of needed some process and procedure around dealing with issues of family unity.
Well, that family harmony and family unity issue is a critical one for, you know, our listeners that are involved in family businesses, for sure. I mean, I've been involved in family business, and I know lots of friends, and there's always issues and problems, you know, generally between fathers and sons or brothers that are in the business. And so I guess what you're telling us, which I like to hear, is that this structure has helped, you know, sort of, modify that and allows for a vehicle to keep that from being a minimal distraction in business operations. Am I right?
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, in business, you know, you get an opportunity to choose your partners, but in families, you go to dance with the family you're dancing with. And so I think we needed to be somewhat purposeful. Maybe to answer your question, Scott Family Services became kind of the support entity for the family council and for the family. In our family, it is really the family office. It helps provide some tax and administrative services, but really it's the place that we as a family can get together. It's a physical space, it's a meeting space, and we've got a team of people that we work with that really help kind of keep the coordination of getting a family of, 60, 80 people together on a regular basis.
So there are probably lots of other businesses or business entities or property or assets owned by the overall family, but the one that jumps out the most is Padlock Ranch, 475,000-acre Montana, Wyoming cattle ranch with 11,000 or plus or maybe 12,000 cattle, one that's won environmental awards for being environmentally conscious. How does that fit in? Do you have any role in that, and how does that fit into the overall? Because it's such a big operation. It's one of the largest ranches in the United States.
The Padlock Ranch is almost the family emblem. You know, we talk about where our sense of place is. I think for the last 75 years, the Padlock Ranch has really been the heart of our family, and, you know, started by my grandfather, but really stewarded through the years by my Uncle Dan. And I care a lot about the ranch. I'd say that, you know, I grew up working on it in the summertime, and we go there and hunt in the winters and fall. But I'm not a rancher by trade, so I've got some other family members that are a lot more interested and engaged with the ranch. And because of our commitment to it, we've decided that the ranch is going to be an entity that will hold into the future, and if not into perpetuity, at least it's important to us. And so, you know, we kind of always go back to the ranch, as that's where our center is spiritually.
I want to switch gears a little bit with you.
Sure.
At this point. For our listeners, we're talking with James Scott Jr., Vice President of First Interstate Bank Systems, grandson of founder of First Interstate Bank, Homer Scott. So what does a potential customer partner who's looking to use your capital for investment, what do they have to do to stand out?
I'm obviously excited to work with somebody who's enthusiastic about what they're doing, but also has a real good, strong understanding of their business plan and their numbers, you know, how they're going to achieve on what they say they're going to do, you know, what the capital is going to be used for. I'm also looking for somebody who can execute. What have you done in the past that, in your mind, demonstrates your ability to be able to excel in the future? And so, you know, looking at capacity and what they've done in the past. But, you know, I've been very proud of some of the work that we've done locally with some of the entrepreneurs that are coming out of the Blackstone Launchpad. I've personally enjoyed being connected to kind of the entrepreneurial climate and the people that are participating in that here in Missoula. And, you know, there have been a handful of deals that have come out of the Launchpad where it's really been, you've got an entrepreneur who's taken something, they've got the product or the service, and they've got some customers there. So it's not a from the ground startup, but they're really looking to grow to the next level. And, you know, through one reason or another, we're able to kind of get comfortable with the risk. And I've got a handful of young entrepreneurs that I've worked with. It's been really fulfilling for me.
James, tell our listeners who are not familiar with the Blackstone Launchpad exactly what it is.
Well, if I understand it correctly, and I'll try and do it as best as I know, it is an advisory unit on campus at the University of Montana that was, I think, originally endowed through the Blackstone Company. But they're staffed with some great people that provide, you know, advisory service and consulting for current and alumni students of the university as regards to their business or entrepreneurial opportunity. You know, they have continued to churn out great young entrepreneurs in the Missoula market.
So, James, give me an example of something that really kind of is interesting, unique, that you're involved in, that you can talk about on the air.
I'll plug a couple of people that I've worked with here and maybe just in general. There was a gentleman who came out of the Launchpad who had a real interest in filming. You know, he had done action filmmaking and he was really, frankly, a serial entrepreneur. He's involved in a couple of different things right now. He's got a cider business he's getting going. But he had invented this gimbal, which was, you know, a device that allows you to keep the camera steady. And he somehow had gotten enough marketing on this deal that he'd found a camera company back east that wanted to buy, you know, 150 units or something. And it was in the perfect, you know, storm of, I've got a great product. I've already figured out how to do it. I've got a supplier that can deliver the things that I need, but I just need the working capital to get there by virtue of him really showing me I've got this contract and I just need to scale. He came into my office on a Monday, and I think we had closed the loan on a Thursday, and we gave him the $150,000 that he needed to send off to China and get this contract fulfilled. And I think it was really transformative for him. He rode the business through for about 18 months and actually sold it at a multiple. And, you know, to be honest with you, that's a great success story.
That is fantastic. Yeah. And it belies the fact that most people think, in general, that it takes a long time to get through the process at the bank, and that becomes daunting, and sometimes dissuades them from getting involved. So what would you credit, you know, your success to?
I think in the deals that it's made the most difference, it's just cultivating and developing a good relationship with people or with an individual or with an organization. It takes time, and oftentimes, at least as a banker, I know that sometimes these deals take months and even years. And that just means just showing up and being there and show support. You know, it just takes time. But developing those meaningful relationships, that to me is what it's all about. And I think how you can differentiate yourself as a banker or as any employee, frankly, is just putting in the time.
So Montana leads the nation in startups and entrepreneurship. What advice do you have for a startup that's walking in the door of the bank looking for money? You know, what do they have to be prepared to demonstrate when they sit down across the table from you?
That's a great question. And I was talking to somebody about this the other day. I think being able to demonstrate proof of concept enough that if we start talking about something and I have some questions about, you know, okay, so you've got a great idea, but, you know, how are you going to make this sustainable? You know, you buy a bunch of supplies and you sell out your first run. How are you going to sustain that? Second, I think knowing your numbers, knowing if I buy something at a particular cost, I can turn around and sell it at X plus, and knowing your margins and then knowing how you're going to be able to cover your overhead through that margin. And then I think the third thing really is just execution. And execution is something I need to either see that through what you've done in the past, or it's something that evolves over time as we work together. But I've heard that statistic. I think it's a great statistic about how Montana is really a great place for entrepreneurs. I'd be curious to know how many of these entrepreneurs make it to year two or year three. And I would say that, you know, the differentiator in that is really execution and, you know, figuring out how to sustain your idea for the long term. I don't know. Does that make sense? I
think it makes perfect sense. And also, I think you would agree that you also invest in the person themselves. Beside their business plan and their track record, you're looking eye to eye to somebody across the table and wanting to feel that they're the right partner for the bank to be involved with.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, exactly. It's that person is the one who's going to execute. Your pivot charts and your spreadsheets don't execute. It's you or your team or your business are the ones that are going to execute. So when you provide to me, you know, your operating plan, yeah, it's the person that does it. And then at the end of the day, if things don't go as how they planned, it's really the character of that person that's going to help figure out the way out of it. So yeah, by all means, it's really we're not only just lending to spreadsheets, we're lending to the person.
Lastly, James, what's next for you in your pathway to the top of First Interstate Bank System?
Well, with this new market, there are lots of opportunities, and I just interviewed and am now accepted a position as the commercial loan manager for Southern Oregon. So within the next 30 to 45 days, I've got to figure out how to pack our family up and relocate to Medford, Oregon. I know we've got lots of roots in Montana, and I'm excited, obviously, to look at the new opportunity. I'd be sad to leave Missoula. You know, obviously appreciate the friendships and the relationships we built here, but as is often the case in your career, you've got to go where the job is. So that's probably the most immediate thing for us.
Well, we wish you great success in that move. I have a sneaking suspicion you'll be back in Montana at some time in the not too distant future.
Yeah, that's great.
We've been talking with James Scott Jr., Vice President of First Interstate Bank Systems, about the fascinating nature of a family-run public entity and what the bank looks at in terms of investment partnerships. Thank you for joining us today, James.
Thank you, Ernie.
I appreciate your listening to Can Do, Lessons from Savvy Montana Entrepreneurs, produced in association with Montana Public Radio. For comments, recommendations for future guests, or general information, please reach out to us at mtpr.org. There you can also find all the contact information from previous guests and content from previous shows. Until the next episode, this is Arnie Sherman wishing you good health and success. This show is made possible with support from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.